Welcome to another edition of In the Clear.
I'm Willie Anderson. Hello.
And this is a good brother, Dr. Oliver. Hello to you.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Doing well. Here we are in a new month, February 2016. Can you believe it already?
It's already here.
Already.
I'm embracing and welcoming it.
So, tell me what we have for today.
Well, today we have an interview with James Anderson.
Who, pray tell, is James Anderson?
Oh, pray tell, huh?
Pray tell.
James Anderson that I'm speaking of is a professor at the University of Chicago at Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Yes, he's a department chair and head.
Oh,
and,
okay.
You know, he researches the history of African Americans in education.
Wonderful.
In the U.S. And so I met him at the ASALA conference in Atlanta.
ASALA?
The Association for the Study of African American Life and History.
Appropriate not only for just February, right?
Exactly. And the founding member of the organization is one and only Dr. Carter G. Woodson, who is...
Hey, the father of Black history. Is that what you're going to say?
Okay, I was wondering. I was like, well, come on.
Month
now.
Or
come
founder on. Attributed to him, right?
Right, right. So, you know, it started as a day, then it moved to a week.
Okay.
And now we have a month.
Educate me, brother.
And we have folks complaining
Remind me.
About it being in existence. You heard about
or
crazy
even
girl
being the
Stacey.
Shortest month.
The
but,
shortest
but the fact that it's even celebrated.
Even celebrated. So you've heard some of the controversial comments that have been attributed to Miss Stacey Dash.
Sure.
And some of the comments that have come back to her in response to that.
And her defense was to quote someone else as such as Morgan Freeman.
Right. So the understanding from that story
mm-hmm.
is that one was speaking of inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
That, yes, African-American history should be a part of American history because it's a part of the fabric of that history. So it doesn't need to be excluded out. However, mm-hmm. since it doesn't exist in the curriculum of our historical awareness or society, there was need and still is need for it to exist. Whereas the other was saying, well, it doesn't need to exist at all because mm-hmm. we're in a particular year and we have certain people of color who are in positions of power. We need to just get rid of all of it all the way together. And that's attributed to Ms. Stacey Dash.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's appropriate that we have these interviews with scholars and researchers and historians and community members who know the history and who mm-hmm. see how it applies in present context. And that's part of what Dr. Anderson does.
Let's hear something from him.
Okay, sure.
Currently, I'm a professor of history and history of education at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. I'm really originally from Alabama, was born and raised there.
Which part?
A place called Eutaw, Alabama. It's in Greene County, which is in the Black Belt. As you know, the Black Belt is like 17 counties in the middle of Alabama, right in the heart of the cotton plantations.
Okay.
And of those 17 counties, 15 are majority Black. And my county, Greene County, was 80% Black and at the end of the Civil War, end of slavery, and is 80% Black today. So it's a it's a Black majority county where I was born and raised, went to elementary and high school there. And then ended up going to graduate school at Illinois and eventually staying there on the faculty. I've been on the faculty there for 40 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So currently your role at Illinois is what?
Professor and the department head. I'm the head of the Department of Education Policy, Organization Leadership, and that department focuses on issues of educational policy, history of education, sociology of education, ed administration, as well as human resource development.
One of the books that is right at the forefront of my library, The History of African American Education in the United States from,
1860 to 1935.
Could you share a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to get some understanding, particularly at the time when 90%, more than 90% of African Americans lived in the southern states. And that would be true roughly from the end of the Civil War through the Depression. I think the out-migrations of World War II and the 1960s, which was the greatest out-migration of Blacks from the South to the North, changed that demographic. But I wanted to study Black education at a time when the vast majority of African Americans lived in those states, to get a sense of, you know, what was education like for them, what kinds of education was offered to them, but more than anything else, I want to get a sense of what did they do, how did they respond, what were their values, what did they build for themselves as well. And so, growing up there, I was aware of a lot of things, but I really had never focused in on it as an area of study. And so I set out to write a comprehensive history of the education of African Americans, roughly from the end of the Civil War. And I stopped at 1935 because I recognized that after 1935, that World War II was going to be a great out-migration. And by the 1960s, the black population, if you think about it, at the end of the Civil War, there were three southern states with a majority black population, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina. By 1935, no southern state had a majority black population. Because,
wow.
You know, the disenfranchisement that took place at the end of the 19th century, around 1900, and the persecutions that followed, and the lynchings, people have to remember that from roughly 1890 to around 1910 and so forth, they were lynching African Americans at a rate of five per week. Yeah, and so that was just lynching.
That's across the United States, or is that?
Southern states.
Just the southern states.
Which is where more than 90% of the black people live.
Right.
And so that kind of persecution, the disenfranchisement, you couldn't vote, you could no longer hold political office, in the long run caused a lot of African Americans to leave the southern states and to migrate to places where they could have a better opportunity for work, their children could get a better education, or at least in some cases, even have access to a public high school. And as well as that, they could participate as other citizens in terms of voting and being able to hold political office as well. So beyond 1935, the situation of the black population within the United States changes dramatically. And you're no longer dealing with the majority just looking at them in the southern states. So my book was to say, okay, more than 90% of African Americans live in these states. And so let's look at the education at the end of slavery, through Reconstruction, through the rise of Jim Crow and segregation at the turn of the century into 1935, which is the middle of the Depression.
So what were some of the important themes that you found during that time period that covers or expresses what happened for education for African Americans?
Well, about three come to mind. One was that at the end of the Civil War, the beginning of, emancipation, roughly until the end of the 19th century, that is roughly 1900, that African Americans had much more control over their education during that time period, and there was much more equality. That if you would look at things like the distribution of school resources, that is the funding for schools, the length of school terms, pay to teachers, other kind of measurements of equality, roughly from 1868 to around 1900, black education in those states was roughly equal to that of whites. Mm. Now, in the late 19th century, blacks were disenfranchised. They could no longer vote or hold office. And the disenfranchisement had a profound effect on the inequalities that would result after 1900. And they were just simply vast. I'll give you one example from my home state. If you look at the school funding that went to schools in 1900 in Alabama, the black population was 40% of the school population. They got 41% of the school funds in 1900. By 1915, they were still 40% of the school population. They only got 11% of the school funds.
So how did they maintain?
What they were able to maintain is that as long as they could vote and hold office, they were able to use that political leverage to protect and even give themselves advantages in the field of education. Mm. And sometimes we forget that. I mean, even our institutions, Tuskegee Institute was a normal school that was brought about in exchange for black votes. Mm. They elected the legislator from Macon County. And the promise they made is that if you get our votes, we get a normal school.
Wow.
Alcorn State in Mississippi, a land grant. You know, Revels, who was the U.S. Senator, left the Senate to become president of Alcorn State. Again, is that we're using our political power, using the ballot, using our positions in office to get education resources for our children. Now, once we were disenfranchised around the turn of the century, we could no longer demand anything from the states or from local governments. And so we're living in white supremacy states now, controlled by a white legislature and governors, and they use their power to bring about the greatest inequality in public education that we've seen in American history.
Even compared to what's happening now?
Yes, even compared to what happened now. the interesting thing about what's happening now, it actually throws us back to the turn of the century.
Right.
Because we went through a period with the 1965 Voting Rights Act in which black people were enfranchised for the first time since the 19th century. And you could see the results of that. You could see the leverage that was starting to have on education. But what's happening now is that we've been disenfranchised once again.
Right.
You know, with all these voter ID laws and various kinds of changing the voting dates, the time of voting, whether you can register on the same day, all of these changes are meant to disenfranchise black voters. Mm. And once you're disenfranchised, then what leverage can you have on education? Because education is essentially a state system controlled by state government and local government. If you can't elect officers, if you're not on the school board, if you're not an elected official, we're completely being pushed out of the decision-making process. Mm-hmm. So that means those who are in state government, who are in the decision-making process, now can divide the school fund the way they want to.
Right.
You know? And we're looking at New Orleans post-Katrina, where they're just closing public schools.
Right. Going they took that to, as an opportunity as, to implement
exactly.
the policies that have now, been on the board anyway.
Yes. Now, imagine. If you went back to 1868, that would have been impossible. Because the Constitutional Convention in Louisiana was full of black folk. The lieutenant governor was black. Blacks were in local districts and so forth. You couldn't do that to black people in 1868 or 1870, 1878. Because we were an enfranchised people and we used our political power to protect our interests. Now, we don't have any political power in the state. We can't protect our interests.
It's diluted at best.
It's diluted at best. And they pretty much can give us what they want us to have. If we wanted to change this whole thing with charter schools and choice in private schools, we couldn't change that right now. We don't have the political leverage to do so. We really are on the mercy of someone else to be able to bid in our behalf or do good things for our children.
So that was the first thing.
Yeah.
Civil War,
yeah.
Emancipation,
yeah.
control, equality, disenfranchisement.
Yeah.
What were the other two?
The other thing was, okay, in the midst of this, and particularly when African Americans were disenfranchised, and they could no longer use local and state government to get local and state government to get educational benefits for their children, what did they do? You know, and then the focus turns to how do we behave under that kind of oppression? How do we respond? And that's when I focused in on the ways in which African Americans built their own schools, provided money for the establishment of their own schools and for their educators. That we actually turned inward, and we sort of fortified our community from the inside, and despite the oppression, we were still able to protect ourselves, to build an educational system out of our own pockets, you know, and to keep moving forward for a better day. Now, that better day didn't come for a long time, but at the same time, at a time when many of our children had no public schools at all, we built those schools ourselves with our own contributions. Provided teachers, kept them going. And so we weren't able to, say, build a high school system because that was very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But between 1900 and 1930, we were able to build an elementary school system where virtually every African-American child had access to at least an elementary school education.
Mm-hmm.
High schools didn't come until later. This is post-World War II. Many African-Americans between 1900 in the post-World War II era, lived in places where they didn't have high schools. What they did when they disenfranchised us was to simply take public education as much as they could away from us. An example, Sunflower County, Mississippi, heavily populated black county in 1957, had no public high schools for black children. None.
1957.
3 years after Brown v. Board of Education.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you ask, well, so how did black kids have an education? Well, the black communities, building their own private schools, using the churches to educate people, did as much as they could to educate those children in the absence of any public support. Now, the thing that we have to remember is that black people were still paying taxes for public education.
Right.
Those taxes were being collected and diverted to support white public schools. And even Booker T. Washington, you know, one of the things that at the end of his career that he really, really disappointed him was the fact that he recognized that money was being taken away from black schools and diverted to white schools.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote a letter to that effect to say that you know, that he asked a question whether his reign supposed to be, his regime had been able to do a lot of good, because he was looking at an America where black kids were being deprived of an education by state and local government, and they were taking black tax money and diverting. And he wrote about this, and he was right. I mean,
which letter was this, or which piece was that?
He was writing a letter to his supporters, you know. And in one of those letters, and he says, "I wonder if I've done any good at all," because he'd done a whole lot of good,
right?
And that was Tuskegee and other things as an example in all the offshoots. But the thing that he was really disappointed about was that he was born and raised in a time when the distribution of educational resources was more equal. I mean, he was born in slavery. So he lived through the Reconstruction, through the 1880s, through the 1890s. So he was in Alabama in 1900 when black kids got 41% of the school resources. Now, he only lived to 1915. So the last 15 years of his life, he observed that same state to reduce the amount of funding to black children from 41% to 11% of the school fund, as they remain 40% of the school population. That's the thing that really disappointed him in the end. But we can't forget that black people in local communities, churches, and throughout the southern states did not simply give up. They used their own private resources, their own private money, their own private churches. And you know, I've gone through these states like Alabama, Mississippi, places like that, and one of the questions I said, well, how many of their educational institutions was publicly owned? How many were privately owned? And most of their states, most of the schools that black children went to were privately owned, not publicly owned, because the states refused to provide public education to African-American children.
Is there a third theme, or have we wrapped those into what we've talked about so far?
I think the third theme was really to look at both state governments and philanthropy to get a sense of, you know, what were they doing and why were they doing this, and really to not take it for granted, but sort of understand what was their purpose when they looked at the education of African American children, and to realize that it wasn't just accidental that we were being deprived of education, but that they had in mind a vision, you know, of economic development, of race relations, that literally places at the bottom. And so the belief that we shouldn't have any more education than what they consider to be our place in southern states. And so the notion of limiting African American education to very little schooling, depriving them of high school education, having only enough students to go to college that would serve. I mean, let's not forget, you needed some African Americans to have higher education. You needed principals of every high school. You needed a principal of every elementary school. You needed teachers. So other than providing for that, they didn't want African Americans to have any more education than that, to be lawyers, to be doctors, to be accountants and things like that. Really looking at states in the ways that they narrowed the opportunities for African Americans in education, so that we would simply have a place at the bottom of that society. So I wanted to study state governments. And sometimes people get, in time, people will rewrite history. It's like looking at the Confederate monuments now, where someone will say, well, it's about heritage, it's about legacy, it's about state rights. And if you go back and read, and they forget that every state that succeeded from the Union had a declaration of secession. Mm-hmm. And when you read those declarations, it's about slavery and about white supremacy. And so,
and that's the part that's often missing in those dialogues and those conversations.
Yeah, and the people who are saying that don't read them. I said, go and read the secession for Tennessee, the secession for South Carolina. Read what they said when they succeeded from the Union and why they succeeded, you know, to protect slavery and to protect white supremacy. So when you say you're celebrating the Confederacy heritage, those are the only two things you really celebrate, is slavery and white supremacy. Mm-hmm. You know? And so one of the reasons to study, you know, governments, both at the state and local level, and to study even in the private sector, philanthropy and others who contribute to the development of black education, is to have a clear understanding of why they did what they did. And that was the third theme I wanted to understand.
So when you expressed that, that component or that layer that's missing. What do people say who are speaking on behalf of celebration, with air quotes, mm-hmm. of the Confederacy?
Well,
what's the retort for that?
It's you like get different kinds because it's complex. There are some people who really don't know because it's not something they've studied. They've just heard from other people, you know, and heard from organizations like the Conservative Citizen Council or something, or they heard from right-wing organizations, or they heard from different people to say, this is why we have the Confederate flag and Confederate monuments and so forth. It's about a heritage. It's about recognition of war heroes and things like that. And so they really don't know what it was about. And so part of it is for those individuals and for those groups is to say, look, take a look at this and see what it was about. I think in some cases like that, you get an awakening. I think we saw some of that after Charleston,
right.
in South Carolina. Even the president going in and saying, you know, I'm sorry, but this is about slavery and about white supremacy.
Right.
Now, that's the people you're trying to reach. But you also want African Americans to know what it's about. We shouldn't just presume that we automatically know what it's about. Occasionally, you get some of them say, well, I don't see what's wrong with the flag.
Right. That you means can always find one or two.
Yeah, that means they also don't know. And even some high-level politicians were in some ways trying to protect this thing. So part of it is educating people that don't know. The other part, and I learned this because I've been an expert witness in court cases and Ayers v. Fordyce in Mississippi on higher education, Knight versus Alabama on higher education. And being on the witness stand and watching people in the courtroom, including the lawyers who are defending those southern states and mm-hmm. defending those traditions, one thing you recognize is that in order to maintain oppression, you not only have to keep the people who oppress ignorant, you also have to keep a good part of your community ignorant.
Right.
Right. And so
they can implement that
yes,
layer
yes.
of oppressing those who are
yes.
beneath.
Yeah.
You want to
keep
it
that
way.
And so in my testimony, I realized they really didn't know. They had some ideas. For instance, you know, when you look at historically black colleges or schools and so forth, in their view, they didn't see it as a system of oppression.
Mm.
They said, well, you had your school over here, and I had my school over there. It was just a matter of separation.
Mm.
And you go, no, that's not what it was about. It was about oppression. It was about mm. denying opportunities to African Americans. It wasn't just simply about separation. You know, it's not so much that African Americans were eager to integrate and mix with you. They understood that there were two systems of education.
Right.
You know, and that they had a system that was meant to repress them in so many ways. And so having them to understand just the nature of repression itself, bringing it face to face, and that's a difficult thing too. It's difficult for people to face the history squarely, to just look it in the mirror and say, it's very difficult for them to say, yeah, that's what this secession was all about. Mm-hmm. It was about slavery and white supremacy. It's a difficult thing to bring people to that point where they look in the mirror and see it face to face. And so there's so much room, so many reasons and so many ways to maneuver to escape that. And so what we want to do is simply to say, whatever position you come out with, whatever independent judgment you make is okay. But we're simply asking you to face it squarely.
Mm.
You know? And what I learned in the courtroom and testifying, that people would sometimes come to face something that they never really faced before. They had other illusions. And if you think that Jim Crow and segregation was simply about keeping the races separate, it seemed like, well, okay, it was a much milder form of oppression.
Right.
But when you realize that the institution like Mississippi State, or like Ole Miss, provided for you advantages and ways to access to opportunities and ways to grow and develop and control the economy and control the politics. And over here with Mississippi Valley State or Alcorn, the same opportunities are being denied to African Americans. It's not just about separate institutions. It's about institutions where one is to develop you and prepare you to control the economy and politics of the state. And the other one is to keep people from even participating in
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you want them to understand. It's not just about separation. It's about, and you know, and I've said it on the witness stand. I said, in a common sense way, I said, if you think about all the southern states There was never a time when the races were separate. I said black people were cooks in the homes. They were
always
managed.
Together, right?
They were always together. If it was about separation, you know, that. I said, it really was about subordination. I said, you could be intimately involved in a family. You could be a cook in the home. You could be the yard boy cleaning the yard. You could be the nanny keeping the baby. But you couldn't go to the front door. Mm. You had to come through the back door. You could be mixed and together. And said, now what do you think that was about? That was about the fact, not about separation. Subordination. You had to come to the back door to affirm your subordination, your place in society. You had to drink out this water fountain, not so much because to affirm your subordination. So the whole system of Jim Crow was not to keep the races separate. It was actually to keep the races in a dominant and subordinate relationship. You know, and one of the things that I, the reason I study state government in their third theme is to be able to articulate the ways in which that dominant and subordinate relationship was carried out and literally implemented and executed over a long period of time.
So someone here, this segment, someone here.
So good, brother. Thank you for that information from Dr. James Anderson. What would be, for you, the takeaway?
I think part of the takeaway is his connection to the importance of community being engaged in the voting process at all levels, not just the national elections, but the local elections. He made the connection that in the early 1900s, communities of color, African-American communities in particular, in the Deep South were more engaged in the voting process and governance than they are now. And we're talking predominantly black communities, but there's been a disenfranchisement in that process. And there's been a ripple effect with local government, educational outcomes, school boards, city councils, and all of those things have a direct impact on our life trajectories and well-being.
I would agree.
So with that, we'll close out because I think we've covered a lot and just need a little time to let it settle in. You know, and remember that it's not just about the month to remember our history, because our history is American history. We need to continue to stand for what we know is right, what we believe to be right, the values and beliefs that lead and guide our lives. And in order for that to truly happen, we remember what Dr. Anderson shared during the interview, we have to be engaged. And engagement happens at all levels of government. As we know, politics, it starts locally. Mm-hmm. And so getting those issues of what you want to appear in text and in the curriculum for our students, it happens locally. And so we need to be engaged at the local level, at the state level, and then, of course, at the national level. Mm-hmm. And that way it keeps us from being disenfranchised. It keeps us in the conversation. It keeps us at the table. It keeps us with the finances continue to flow into our community so that we not only educate our own children, but we educate all children because all children are our children.
All children matter.
All children matter.
But for sure, black lives matter. African-American history matters. Black history matters. However you put it, we matter.
It matters.
Are we in the clear?
I think we're in the clear.
Thanks, Doc.
You're welcome, good sis.
You are in tune to KZI 88.7 FM. I'm Willie Anderson along with
the good brother, Dr. Oliver.
And this is In the Clear Community Learning Exchange
Advocacy Radio.
And we thank you for joining us. We'll talk with you next time.
We're in the clear.
We're in the clear.